This is the Limalista podcast between. This week I'm talking to Liz Medina in Chile, who I met through my Sean Atwood interview when she reached out to me. There's a rock inside my chest.
Hi, so how's everything over there?
It's okay, considering how much stress that I think 90% of the world seems to be under. I'd say things are going pretty well.
I imagine it's really laid back over there anyway, energy-wise.
Well, in general, where I live obviously has a lot to do with it, yes. There's no...
It's pretty good here too. It's just when you get on the net, it gets really hairy, depending on where you go, who you listen to.
When you get on the what?
On the net.
Oh, yes. I know. Okay, it's a whole different story.
Yeah, they're like two camps. One is like, everything's great. The war's won. The other one is, they're passing these draconian laws everywhere in Australia and in London, blah, blah, blah.
I haven't heard many people saying everything's great, the war is won. I think even those folk are having to curb their enthusiasm a bit.
I don't know.
Really? So I have to confess that, there's no real reason, just because I have so many pounds in the fire, that I haven't really read anything you sent me, except obviously your emails.
That's fine.
So I'm not up to speed on all of that stuff.
No problem. I just wanted to show you that I was legit.
Uh-huh. What does that mean, legit?
I mean, I have been writing, it's just that I do it at my own pace. That's all. Well, I'm not like you. I have no dreams of breaking into the mainstream, but, to each his own.
I would say that's a healthy sign. I mean, I would be just as happy to be rid of the dream as to fulfill the dream. And I think I'm definitely closer to that end result,
yes.
Know what I mean. I mean, just it's becoming less and less important. And
that means it's going to be there soon, so that's good.
Well, maybe I won't be there when it is. If I'm off milking goats somewhere in the Spanish wilderness, then I suppose I'll still check my Twitter every now and then, probably.
Well, whatever. It's a crazy time, and it's also a very interesting one. So.
Yes.
I feel like the atmosphere is more favorable for people like me to come out of the woodwork,
Right. What do you want? Should we unpack that a bit? What do you mean by people like you, and what's the woodwork, and what would coming out look like?
Well, the way the world was, everything was kind of a mainstream media planet, The people who existed, the people who were visible, were the same old, same old. And the voices were just the Hollywood, the Hollywood scene. Everybody was trying to be like that. And now that everything's sort of collapsing and everything's in free fall, there are more possibilities of alternative voices. Sorry. I don't know. It's just more interesting. It's like Chile, I really hated living here for decades. And then what happened in last October happened, and suddenly I could be out in the street and everybody was like on the same page. And the falsity had dramatically evaporated. It was like we just weren't buying the scam anymore. the scam reality.
What happened last October?
Oh, you don't know? It was just like everybody reached boiling point and we all, well, not me so much, everybody went out to the streets demanding an end to the inequality and the fact that the dictatorship never ended. That this is a false democracy. There had been several scandals erupting through the years. Same thing that's happened in the States, for example. But here, one of the really egregious scandals was that it came to light that Carabineros de Chile had been stealing billions of dollars. Their hierarchy had been using their subordinates to accept huge deposits from institutional funds for their personal purposes, and those subordinates would take a cut and then transfer them the rest of the money. And this had been going on for over a year. And considering the economic precarity of most Chileans, you know, it just drove us. And then, you know, they've raised the fares for the subway. And that was like the stick that broke the camel's back, because the high school kids decided to invade the metro stations without paying, and they just took over. Mm. And that was the beginning of it. And then everybody else just hit the streets to protest, because they said it's not just that fares went up 30 pesos. It's been 30 years that we've been putting up with this bullshit, you know.
Right.
And suddenly this happiness erupted. Everybody just kind of, I guess it must have been like, you know, Paris 68 or something.
No, well, I hadn't heard about this.
Well, you can see there's YouTube videos all over. It was amazing. And then this COVID business erupted and everybody just had to be under house arrest. And it has stopped all of the, what do you call it, the ebullions.
Well, maybe it was you guys that made the COVID necessary. Like, oh, there's a problem in Chile, better release the virus.
I'm sure it was part of it, because, I don't know. The other thing is that I was a biomagnetism therapist. I was quite active. In 2005, I got my training, and I've been dropping, comments on the net for several years already. When I've come across people talking about their medical problems and how terrible they were, and they could be resolved with magnets, but there's a lid on biomagnetism, you know, and during the years that I was really, that was a priority for me, and people were coming to see me, I saw some really incredible things happen. And that's one of the things about Chile, you know, there are things about this place that are fantastic, you just have to get away from the society. The society is just horrible. The elitist classes, Chilean society is really unbearable, intolerable. But there's like a whole world, there are several worlds parallel to that that make it worthwhile being here. So
it's probably not that different from anywhere else in that regard, I imagine. There's at least two worlds. I mean, well, there's the society and nature as the extremes, but then there's, of course, the different class stratospheres and whatnot. So,
however, I came to the conclusion a long time ago that Chile is in the 19th century. You know, it's just you've got a veneer here of modernity.
Right. So that's a good thing, would you say? or not.
It's awful.
Oh, but the 21st century surely is no better than the 19th, is it?
Oh, I mean things like ideas of liberty, fraternity, and all that stuff never arrived here.
It's oh, I see.
The same setup as 200 years ago.
So it can be an open dictatorship, you mean?
Everything's fake.
But this is, you're describing the U.S. now.
Well, yeah, the U.S. kind of got Latin Americanized. Uh-huh. You know, I lived in California in the 70s, and it was so different. And I don't understand why people complain about, or they badmouth socialism so much in the States when it was pretty socialist, but in the good sense, you know. Labor was respected. You know, your work had value. They weren't saying that the only professionals were the ones who had their big degrees. Anybody who worked and got paid for it was a professional, you know? But now this idea of only certain people are equal got put out deep tentacles in the state. But I left it a long time ago. So when I went back in the 80s, I really could see how yuppieism and money had become the main preoccupation of people.
When did you leave it?
I left in 82.
So you left at the beginning of the neoliberal
yes.
shift.
Yeah. What about you? When did you move to Canada?
In 2008.
Ah. But were you in England before that?
I was in England. I'd been in England for about 2 years, partly or even mainly because of the socialist support system in England, the housing benefit and so on. So I've been a beneficiary of socialist policies in my life. So I'm reluctant to badmouth them, but of course, I do question them in my book, and the thing I've understood about the Fabian Society and the way that socialism has been used and wielded as a means to engender dependency and to right. bestow more and more power to the state is more how I understand socialism now as a political movement, let's say. On the other hand, to contrast that, you know, my research, my direct experience running a thrift store in a small town, which is a very, very simple kind of community-based job work that provides us income that feels, you know, very totally earned and right. justified, and at the same time we run it on egalitarian principles. We charge very little money, and we give clothes and food away the people who don't have it, and so on. And the mm-hmm. whole idea is kind of redistribution of property, if not wealth. Mm-hmm. We're not exactly taking from the rich and giving from the poor, but we're taking more from the middle class, and the poor are donating things that they don't need, and then we're selling and sometimes giving away that stuff to mostly the poor. There's a few middle class right. who shop with us. So it's possible that somebody could say that we run our store. I made a joke about it recently, but the person didn't appreciate it. It's kind of communist, our system. But so it is possible that somebody could say that, oh, those values or those principles, because they're not a million miles away. But my take on that is that there's a natural harmony between human beings that can exist, you know, between individuals and a community can naturally arise out of individuals, you know, being in the same place together. I mean, yes. we started as nomads, but then we settle and we become sedentary, and so that's a community. But if we yes. maintain the harmony, then there's a natural system evolves that isn't political in the way we think of it, although it might be in the broader sense, but there's no ideology behind it. It's common sense that is no longer right. common.
something happens when things go massive, right?
Yeah.
And then all kinds of control systems start growing.
Yeah.
But there's something very unbalanced in our civilization. And I'm glad more and more people are waking up to it. And that's why I'm a conspiracy theorist, you know. It's just so obvious to me that something very weird has been going on here for centuries.
Yeah.
And nobody can see it unless they're marginal or they're not getting fat off of it, you know. Well, but that goes back to why I left my family and joined the movement, you know, all those years ago. I've always been a malcontent.
What movement did you join?
Siloism.
Siloism.
I talked to you about it in my emails.
Okay.
And it actually turned out to be a really good thing. And when I left it, it was time to leave it. It had become kind of like a cult, especially in Chile. You know, it was very different according to the country where it was.
Mm.
But Chile is a very special country. It's a very Nazi country, you know. It really is. Well, because of the guys on top, a lot of Germans came here.
Right. I was going to say, if you were literally, meaning literally. Well, before we get into that, if we do, can you say some more about Siloism just so I have a sense of what it is? And
yes, okay. So this started with this guy who I told you I came to consider was not completely human, but was at least half ET. His name was Mario Rodriguez. He was born in Mendoza, Argentina. And in 1969, he was living in the Andes, in the mountains, in a hermit's stone hut. And I'm sure that he already had a certain pulling power because he gave what they call a harangue in 1969 on the healing of suffering. And this guy has always been mysterious to us, but we know that he also did a thing in the maybe 50s and 60s of riding around Latin America on a motorcycle. And I also suspect that he was connected to mystery schools in Europe, which he never spoke about, because he just had such a breadth of knowledge of all of the epochs, really. And well anyway, in 1969, he gave that talk, and young people started to work with him. And he created a system of internal work, and they would do month-long retreats where they would kind of break down their conditionings. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, these were young people in their, some of them were 14, and they had left their families because they were fed up with what was going on, the hypocrisy and, you know, the whole thing. And this happened in Argentina, and then it spread to Chile. Well, these retreats were really great because, like, there would be like leaders, okay? They were called eponymos, and who had worked with him. And they would tell the people who were gonna participate in the retreat, maybe there'd be 15, 20 people, okay, start digging these holes. And after they had dug them, and this was in mountain terrain, they'd say, okay, fill them up again,
Right.
And there was the women could not wear any makeup, you know, all of that stuff from the system out the window. And they ate really simply, like beans, and to the extent that they would all start to have diarrhea after a while. But like, you need to live somewhere, okay, build a hut, you know, stuff like that. And then they would have like meetings where they would read his writings. He had a whole bunch of talks called The Healing of Suffering. And they would, I guess, they would do a self-knowledge works, just like we did in Berkeley in 1973 when I joined the movement there. And it was like getting rid of your conditioning and learning how to work in a team and questioning everything. And those were the five Chileans that I met in Manila in June of 1973 when I was in college and taking French classes. And one of them, a woman, was my teacher. And then I met the five of them, and I was really blown away by these ideas of how we can transform ourselves and society simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you spend in the group?
I was really active for 15 years. So I participated mainly in the States, and I lived there for almost 10 years. And then I went to Berlin with my future ex-Chilean husband, who is the son of German Jews who arrived here in 1939. And in Berlin, we worked with the groups there. In Washington, D.C., sorry. I started in Berkeley, San Francisco, Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And then we had what we call dispersions. And I went to Washington, D.C. with two other couples. And then I went to, it became a worldwide movement. Because CeeLo, who was very prescient, he knew that the dictatorships were going to arise in Argentina and Chile. And he told the young people to spread out, to go everywhere, to go to Europe, but to leave, because, you know, to avoid getting persecuted. And they actually did. The ones who stayed in Chile did get persecuted. And the man that I later married, he had gone to a retreat in Cordoba. And thus the secret police arrived one day, and they picked him up because they thought he looked like a terrorist that they were looking for. And they took him with them in a car out to the country. And for 3 days, he didn't know if he was going to die or not, you know. But he was just really calm. And finally, they let him go. So all of that was going on. And the kids went out to different countries, to Scandinavia, to the States, obviously. And they went to the Philippines because they said, well, the Philippines was a Spanish colony, so they must speak Spanish there. Very few people did, but they arrived and I met them. And it was great. It was a great movement in the States. We had a lot of fun. And when I got to Chile, that's where the thing changed, because that was also in 83. So things, 10 years had gone by. And in Chile, it was much more structured. There were a lot more people. And they were working a lot more with people from the working class and, you know, poblaciones. And so it was a whole different kettle of fish than what I had known in the States, where we were very egalitarian, you know. There weren't that many of us, too, so.
When did it actually start? Do you know?
Sorry?
Do you know when it started, the movement?
In 1969.
69. And did it just start, as far as you know, with this one guy?
He started it, yeah. And there's a whole library full of his writings that the movement has been publishing for years. So it's totally documented. And there are works on psychology that have begun to cite him. And he's another one of those people who has been invisibilized, you know. I was listening to your interview with that guy about a Morris Berman book.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I've read of Jordan, you know, they're good people, but they're missing the bigger picture.
Who's Jordan?
Peterson, sorry.
On first name basis. I wouldn't compare Berman to Jordan Peterson.
I really don't know anything about Berman. What do you think of him?
Well, I don't know a great deal, but I mean, he's very much, Jordan Peterson is a celebrity who went from being a teacher to suddenly being, you know, an international right. figure, mm-hmm. and yeah, a guru. And so an awful lot of pieces, and in my opinion, he's winging it. He's really improvising, which, fair enough. But I wouldn't say he's a very serious, grounded, critical thinker. I think there's such huge holes, but he's attempting to make sense of things. So I think there's a need for that. It's like a demagogue, really. Anyway, whereas Berman, I would say more like myself, somebody who's just been working away on the margin for decades, really, and writing these odd books that
really?
No one's heard of. Yeah, yeah.
But he's respected. He has a reputation, doesn't he?
He has a certain reputation as he's a respected thinker and writer. Yes, but he's an academic. Yeah. Although that term is, you know, a mixed blessing nowadays, I think. But
academics have never changed the world, and they never will.
Well, I'm not interested in changing the world, though. I mean, I think this whole concept
it changes whether you want to or not.
Well, there you go. So, you know, we didn't start a thrift shop to try and make our community a better place, and that's still not an aim. The fact that it happens is maybe, although it would be rash for me to say that, but it appears that I think people really appreciate what we've done, and so for a number of people we have improved the quality of life. That's very encouraging and inspiring, and you know, I'm very grateful for that. But to me, it's very important that I didn't have some idea about this. I mean, you think of the model of a relationship. When two people come together, they pretty soon, usually one of the things that makes the relationship go wrong is, and sometimes it's right there at the beginning, they think, well, this person's great, but they'd be much better if they could fit, right. You know, if they would change it. And so it becomes, rather than a shared exploration, it becomes an attempt to fix each other.
Right, yeah. Right.
And that takes it to hell pretty fast. So that's how I feel about being in our environment,
right.
Not just seeing it as it is and finding ways to engage with it as it is. And that naturally changes, you know, our quality of attention changes. You know,
Have you ever heard of Paulo Freire, the education of the pedagogy of the oppressed?
No, I haven't.
He's an incredible person. He was an academic, but he died in not long ago, I think in 2005. But basically, he wrote this book, which is incredible. He talks, and I recognize the error of the movement, which was to come out on the scene believing that you have something to teach people, you know,
right.
And that you've got the key. But you don't, because in your engagement with people, he developed a way to work with rural peasants, and teach and alphabetize them, you know, literacy.
Yeah.
And he said that you've got to arrive and you've got to know what their way of life is. I mean, you're not just gonna hand them the tablets. You have to live with them. And he analyzes the dynamic between the oppressed and the oppressor, you know?
Yeah.
And for me, since I come from a country that got colonized serially, first by the Spanish and then by the Americans, and here in Chile, I've been able to reflect on that whole brouhaha, you know. Mm-hmm. Paulo Freire talks about how the oppressed are conditioned to admire the oppressor. Right?
Yeah.
And there's like a dependency that happens, and how the oppressor at bottom is feeding on the oppressed and conditions them to believe that they know nothing, that he knows everything, and that they've got to just shut up and let him do what he's got to do, and they've just got to like be the doormat and support everything that that he wants them to do so that they can be better, they can grow better. And this was what happened to the movement, you know, that I finally became like up to here. I couldn't take it anymore and I just had to leave.
Interesting. So you observed that over a long period of time, did you? Or was it more sudden? It was gradual.
Yeah. Right. But you know, it's what's the amazing thing is that it's really good to go through. I believe that if you, it's really positive when you come into a situation with others, and you know, the movement thing for me, because you have like a predisposition to trust others and to work with them shoulder to shoulder and try to bring about changes in the world, because that really is what changes you, you know, mm-hmm. because you realize so much that you really can't change anything from your ego or from your will, you know, that you want to impose. And in that dynamic of engaging with people that I went through, like especially when I came to Chile, because I went to a working class neighborhood and I started to form a group there, a soldier of the movement, right? And I encountered problems I'd never encountered before, like alcoholism and unemployment and boredom, mm-hmm. you know, and I was working with people whom I could just barely understand their Spanish, you know. And I became like, I bonded with them because Filipinos bond, you know, that's like one of our, it's one of our, the good things about us that has worked against us historically is our willingness to bond and be permeable to others. And finally, after working in that community for 2.5 years, going every other day in my car to work with my group and, you know, create a little newspaper financed by the businesses and, you know, talking with them about a political project, because at that time it was like a political thing. I finally had to leave because it was so depressing for me and I felt like I didn't have anything to offer them. And when I left sometime later, I also had my first child, my daughter. Sometime later, I realized that they were the ones who had humanized me, you know, and that I was bringing them with me from that time on, no matter what I did, you know, they were with me.
How had they humanized you?
Because I had tried to understand them.
Yeah.
You know, and because we had shared experiences, we had done things together. Yeah. I mean, that was the cool thing about the retreat I described to you. They did pretext work, you know? If you run up a mountain, they tell them, run up that mountain and run down again. And, you know, it's like learning to do things as an end in itself, but with a pure intention, you know? That is what transforms you, and it transforms your relationship with the world, you know?
Even the trees and sea, all the people are gray. Even
Yeah, I could see one of the dangers, and maybe this, I don't know if you observed this yourself, but one of the dangers of that would be that to do that, that is seemingly socially meaningless, with a pure intention, that the intention could end up being diverted into the leadership, and that's how you become a cult. In other words, why am I digging this grave just in order to fill it, not a grave, this hole in order to fill it back up? It's because there I'm being told to by the authorities, and it's going to improve me as a person, right? So even if that's true, there's a danger that there'll be that projection onto the authority that's telling you to do it, right?
Right. But there you've got the other half that's got to have the intention of oppressing you. You know what I mean?
I suppose, but it could be a chicken or an egg, because if you have that tendency in yourself to project onto another and want them to control you or look after you, that might inspire that in that other person. They might have been, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a complicity.
But I did forget one little detail. You know, with that pretext work, we were training our attention. Because that was one of the works that we did in the early days, was to train your attention so that you are in the present. Mm-hmm. Because the like one of the foundation blocks of Silo's thought was what he called the theory of reverie, which is that the human being is oriented toward by images, by illusory images. And we're always working toward those images. They orient us, they guide us, sometimes without our even knowing it. Mm-hmm. But basically the human consciousness is magnetized by these images, and we're just mechanically moving toward them without the ability to observe our own behavior and have self-criticism, because we don't have the capacity to attend. You know, we have very little attention capacity. So that was one of the things that we were doing with the pretext work. For example, me and Berkeley, one of the exercises we did was walk around the block and remember everything that you see, and you come back here and you describe the walk. You know? And that really is key, attention.
That would have been natural once upon a time as hunter-gatherers, of course, to be observing and noticing everything. And this is very central to what we were discussing about Berman's book, that we've moved away from this being able to be an unfocused and focused awareness. So we're taking everything in, but without trying always to get something, without always being directed towards some future point or goal, which is where the image comes in. You can imagine, like, a hunter is looking for a particular plant. He might actually have the image of it, and so much so that all he can see is the image, and he's not even noticing what's around him. That would be too focused. So that future orientation, I mean, one of the things that we talked about, there's the formative experience we have of creating an image, and how it might relate to the infant experience of the mother and the mother's body, which, because that's our original source of nourishment. And so as an infant, if the mother isn't there, and I know I had this experience even though I don't remember it, if she isn't there when we need her, then we're all of our bodies crying out for, and we may start to generate or have this image, the mother, you know, where is she? And that image becomes so central to our awareness, because she's not there, that we get locked into this habitual obsessive relating to images. Like the power to create image becomes so hardwired to our survival and our trauma that it becomes obsessive and compulsive in this way. And I mean, the way I experience it on a moment-to-moment basis is, I think what you're talking about with this group is, it's almost impossible for me not to be thinking in every single moment about what's next. Like, where is this moment going? as if I have to get somewhere in order to be where I am. It's entirely contradictory. Yeah?
Well, that's what we call a system of tensions, you know.
Right.
Because you know, you talk about not having had a mother who was present, and how that image begins to guide you in a way obsessively. Yeah. But if you go back to, if you try to imagine, when you're an infant, you don't even know that, you don't even see that as the image of a woman, you know? It's just, because I had that too. I didn't have a mother who was available to me. My first memory is of being around, I was an infant. I was about one maybe or two. And I had a high fever, and I was in a room that was very hot, and I was alone. I was alone. And as a child, I spent a lot of time alone. And although I did have carers, but I had this, I was in this atmosphere that we called in the movement an emotional climate of being alone, and like of being a point in space, you know, with just like brown, what do you call it, like a speck of dust,
yeah,
you know, and being nowhere, yeah, and having this feeling of oppression that was very subtle, that you didn't interpret as an absence yet, because you didn't have the capacity to formulate such a thing, but you felt like, I felt like I was floating nowhere, you know, and I was like a, it was like a vacuum.
Wow, you remember this
feeling.
It
was like I was empty, you know?
You remember this feeling.
And then the image comes later, which is like, you know, it could be the image of the what do you call it? The woman, you know, the idealized image of your mother or woman in general, or of the father. In my case, my father was the one who gave me some affection, you know, and so that became, that kind of magnetized me toward the male gender, and whereas the female image for me was like a bit hostile, you know, like a competitor, yeah, or even someone who would reject me, you know, if I didn't fulfill certain requirements, yeah.
Yeah.
And well, I just wanted to comment on that when you're very, very little, you don't have images yet. You just have these emotional climates that you're enveloped by. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, Sila was talking about how we are mechanical. It is like the same idea that Gurdjieff talked about, right? Did you ever read Gurdjieff?
No, but I've read a lot about him.
But he talks a lot about illusion too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like we are led by these internal images and we don't even realize it. And to begin to be conscious is to realize what we are led by. And then it becomes like the search for meaning in life, you know, and how you, the images that you attach to that search.
Yes, so I wrote a book called Seen and Not Seen that's sort of about that. It's about my relationship with movies and how much I needed movies or turned to movies anyway as a way to escape from my reality and compensate for it.
Okay, yeah. Right.
And so...
That was very important.
Well, it was, I mean, I didn't have any other alternative, so, but it was entirely unconscious, like you're saying, about when we begin to develop internal imagery, who knows how and when that begins, I certainly don't know, but it would begin unconsciously, that faculty, that ability. I mean, do infants dream, presumably? I mean, does a fetus in the womb dream? It would depend what we mean by dream, wouldn't it? But it seems, I mean, one trajectory that I feel I I can deduce anyway, if not recall, is a development from affective bodily experience, which is sensation based, to one that is more image based, and then that goes hand in hand with becoming more and more aware of perceiving the world as made up of objects,
Or
and that we're,
separate from you.
yeah, we're an object in this world of objects, and we're separate, yeah, because seeing, really, by definition, anything we can see is distant from us, because even if you put your hand close up, you can no longer see it. So the act of seeing and hearing as well is a long distance way of receiving, an experience of the world, whereas sensation's the opposite. It's tactile. We're actually in direct contact with the world and or with existence. And so the image-based world is a safe haven, let's say. It's a refuge. At least this is how I understood and interpreted it. So I was doing it internally, no doubt, even if I don't remember exactly that. And then when movies came along, which is very young, I remember one of the first memories I have, and one of the first movies I remember seeing, obviously it was my mother. She was showing the movie to me, or she actually, it's kind of ironic story because it was a horror movie, and she thought she would sit with me in case me and my friend got afraid. I was about six, 5 or 6, and she ended up being terrified, whereas apparently we weren't. But in any case, that's a formative memory. It's practically my first memory of my mother, or it is my first, and it's a movie. We're watching a movie. So there was something about, there's a transition for me from reality to a false reality, which would have been happening internally, but then was complemented by a literal false reality, the movies. And so the movies just became absolutely central to my identity and my sense of who I was. And then in adolescence, it became conscious because I found Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood became my ideal man, the father I never had, although he'd be a terrible father, Dirty Harry. But anyway, he was a strong man who would protect me, and I didn't have
Right,
that. And
right.
then through Clint Eastwood, I just, my whole world became entangled with movies and love of movies and so on. And that was 40 years ago, and so it's been a
Okay.
this very long journey to try and extricate myself from this matrix that's created by the culture for us. And but it fits. There's a saying, your teeth fit my wound. It's like that. The teeth of the culture perfectly fit my wound, and so.
Okay, I'll introduce another key concept that Seelo developed in his psychology of the image or psychology of the consciousness was that the separation between us and the outer world is defined by our eyes, our eyes separate us from a screen that's external, but inside us, behind our eyes, we have an internal screen, which is called the space of representation. And it's just like a camera, right? And so the external world presents itself as landscapes, and those landscapes come into contact with our external senses. And those are impulses that get translated by the consciousness, and they configure images on this internal space. And this space corresponds to the entire body. And these images get emplaced at certain levels. And these images are not just visual, they're also tactile and they're also auditive. They're also kinesthetic, which have to do with your posture. And they are synesthetic, that have to do with your internal organs of perception that are not visible. I mean, just think of smells, A smell is a type of image. And so we populate our internal screen with all of these images that are external, and also they are of all the different types of sensory inputs. And you know, the space of representation moves from the lightest part, with greatest light, which is the higher up you go, to the darkest part, which is the lower down you go. And it's really fascinating how that is represented in Bosch's The Garden of Earthly Delights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you have the infernal regions, which are darker, and then you have the middle plane, which is, you know, light, and then you have the higher plane, which is populated by beings of a different type than these two other planes. And so in your case, it's like you become exposed to movies at a very young age. I was not. I was exposed to books because, you know, we never went to the movies. I mean, and anyway, my thing was books. But your relationship, this is how I interpret it, your relationship with film also had something to do with your mother. So her being with you the first time you watched the movie also gave it an emotional content, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you adhered to it.
Yeah.
And it also developed your visual apparatus and your ability to process images, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you a very visual person?
Not really, no. I'm not a good visualizer. Like, if I have to close my eyes and create images, I wouldn't say I'm good
at
that
at
all.
Do you remember images?
Do I have
Can you evoke?
Can I what?
Evoke. Can you evoke visual images?
Not really, no. I would say, I mean, I'm very, in terms of my dream life, that's been very vivid. I have a very vivid dream life.
Oh, you do have?
Yeah.
You do remember your oniric images?
As far as dreams go, but as far as when I'm awake, if I were to try and conjure up the image of my wife's face, for example, I wouldn't get anything very clear then.
But are you visual? Do you like, are you attracted to images, visual images?
Well, obviously movies, we've established that, haven't we?
Or are you more attracted to forms, for example, textures?
I'm wanting to say I'm more tactile, but I don't know if that's true or not. But I feel as though I'm more of a sensuous, like I'm more
well,
drawn.
Well, then you are.
Yeah.
Why doubt?
Well, because we're not one thing, are we?
No.
I have all these different perspectives, and they're not always consistent, and some of them are untrue. So,
well, anyway, you come to these things through long observation. You know, you don't. It's not like a snap of the fingers thing.
Well, when you
so basically, CeeLo gave me, you know, and all of us, I suppose, this really interesting way of structuring, right? They talk about the consciousness. I was watching a video of two guys talking about the consciousness. One of them was a Buddhist and the other one was a psychologist, I guess. And they were talking, one of them was talking on and on about how the consciousness came to be, that nobody really knows where it came from or when it arose. And from our point of view, that wasn't of any interest whatsoever, because that was like mental masturbation. You know?
Seems like, doesn't
actually,
it?
And the perspective of Siluism was to connect everything to real life and for things to be useful to the way you live, so that you can understand them from that point of view, right? Mm. And to approach things with that interest of connecting concepts to your real life. And so consciousness was defined in this system as a faculty of our psychism, a psychism being the structure of senses, both external and internal, imagination, memory, and then the consciousness, imagination, right, okay. And then the consciousness was like the faculty that coordinated all of these inputs and that created a structure or a way of structuring reality that was favorable for the development and the expansion of your life or life in general. So if you wanted to say it like really simply, consciousness is what tells you if you're asleep or awake. It tells you if you're at a low level of consciousness or at the high level. It tells you what where up is, where down is, you know. time, it allows you to structure time. What is past, what is present, what is future. And it is very oriented toward future. And it's also very oriented toward meaning, right? Things have to make sense. But according to the level that you're at, that making sense is going to be very different. It will be very distorted, or it will be more ordered, more organized, you know, and more workable. Yeah? So,
one thing that I've noticed a lot, and there's particularly a book I wrote called Prisoner Infinity, which focuses on this, is that for many people, including people who I think should know better, the mind and the consciousness are synonymous. And when they talk or think about consciousness, they're referring to the mind both literally and figuratively, as in they will talk about the mind, but also they are listening to their mind to tell them what consciousness is. And so they have this idea, I could say we because I'm not exempt from it, we have this idea that what we call consciousness corresponds roughly with what we experience as our minds. And my sense is the complete opposite, that the mind is where the least consciousness is in my existence. Like, most of my consciousness is in the body. My body is much more conscious than my mind is. My mind is this little confined area where language has become king, language and image. And I think it might relate with what you were describing in terms of this, the inner representative space. But it can make these movies, and it can tell these stories, and it can, including that I am conscious and I am the source of consciousness and so on. It's got all kinds of stories to tell. But consciousness as a phenomenon, which I kind of agree is sort of meaningless really to try and talk about too much, except in terms of how I experience it. Or don't experience it. It's really to do with the tactile, the material realm, not the conceptual, the tangible existence of life. And because of this, or one question I would have for you anyway about the description you gave, because you were talking about how all the upward is where things are lighter and brighter, and the downward is where they're dark. For me, I feel that's an inversion of the truth, is that I need to go downward. I need to, my awareness needs to come out of my head and go all the way into my body and all the way down to my feet and into the earth, and to have this downward trajectory, whereas the upward one is the conceptual and the abstract, and where I've always been most happy because there's all these things I can play with, but it's not real. It's not real. So anyway,
well, there's a whole mix of things in what you just talked about. I was really talking about the consciousness as coordinator, right? And what you've just spoken to me about has more to do, first of all, mind terminology, right? What you call mind to me is the intellectual center. It's the intellect, right? It's the brain. Or up here. In Spanish, there's a really nice word called intelección, you know. It's the ability to think, okay? Mind is to me I don't know how to say it. Mind and consciousness for me are much more intertwined because, again, of my training with my second teacher, who worked with me on energy, right? Mm-hmm. And from her, her point of view, the mind sends the orders to the intellect in order to activate the centers of energy in the brain. But you have to give the order from the mind. And that, to me, her language makes it sound like the consciousness. You know, your awareness is what gives the orders to your brain to function in this way or that way, or gives orders to your brain to like activate your the sense perception you're interested in working on. You know, like I can, my consciousness will tell my brain, okay, you're gonna walk out to the street, and there's gonna be a, it's been flooding, so send the order to your feet to be very careful where they step, you know? But it's the consciousness that knows what the climatic conditions have been for the past 3 days. Know what I mean? The temperature that you are sensing. But what gives the orders to your body per se? It's your brain, you know?
The brain doesn't tell the heart to beat, though, does it?
Sorry?
The brain doesn't tell the heart to beat. It's not like a hierarchy.
No, but that is, you see, there are different intelligences in the body, and that's where we talk about the centers. You've got the vegetative, sexual, and you've got the motor center, and the emotional, and the intellectual, and the superior center, which can be more than one. But like the all the centers have their intellectual parts, and the intellect of the body are all of those, whatever, sympathetic, parasympathetic, I don't know what they are. But you know, the things that you cannot control. I mean, that control themselves.
Like heartbeat, right? And
the intelligence of the body, yeah. And then you have the intelligence of the emotions, which would be the intuition, right? I can't go much, you know, I haven't studied this stuff for years.
It does sound complicated. Yeah, it does sound very complicated. I'm interested in how...
Can I just say one more?
Yeah, thing? Yeah.
That when you say that you like to go down, and you had said something like that, where you really like to play up here, there's all kinds of fun things you can push, and
yeah.
But what you feel that you need to do is to go down,
yeah,
and to feel or to be in your body,
yeah.
And that totally makes sense, because our big problem in our civilization is that we're dissociated from our bodies. I mean, that was why Morris Berman became really interesting for me.
Yeah,
but. That is not to be confused with what I was talking about the images. That's the study of images. But that's a whole different plane than kind of your existential registers of your body and your life. You know, that's kind of a different area. You know what I mean?
I don't necessarily know, because I don't know what era it is. Have you picked up anything about Deva Oshana from my website?
I was going to look into it, but I didn't have time. Tell me.
I can't remember what I was going to say about him now. What was I going to say? I know I was going to ask you something about your system and that, and maybe that would lead into it. Do you have in there anything about the false identity, or this idea that we have a false self?
Yes.
That,
yes.
That is,
yes,
part of the model,
yeah,
is it?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So what one of the things Dave describes, and I've been participating with his thing for about 13 years, in terms of what happened to him, is that after 30 years or so spiritual seeking and trying to get enlightened, and he doesn't feel that what happened was a result of that, but anyway, he did do a lot of work, body work, and lived a quite a very wholesome lifestyle and so on, so I'm sure that helped. But anyway, at a certain point, what he feels happened was that his life force cleared out enough that the false identity that had installed itself into his nervous system dissolved, unraveled, was pushed out, and he woke up and realized that he was not the person that he thought he was, and he decided to call it enlightenment. And he describes it now as simply the life force or slash the soul fully landing in the body, being fully distributed throughout the whole body, which is prevented by the false identity and the contraction of the nervous system that corresponds with that, in the fascia, the toxins and the trauma and the social conditioning and everything that basically prevents us from just relaxing and allowing our life force to really flow all the way into the body. That this is what finally happened for him. And he's also described recently how it relates to consciousness, that the body is itself aware.
Mm-hmm.
It has awareness, it has sentience.
Mm-hmm.
The mind is the false identity, which has been created through this cultural conditioning combined with trauma, and basically gives us the sense we are this little person living behind our eyes. And is running these dream movies the whole time that prevent us from seeing reality. So once the mind is disidentified with, and awareness is freed from the mind, what he has described is that consciousness, as in our sense of existing, self-awareness perhaps you could say, meets with the awareness of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And the two become one.
Right.
And so for him, the practical, and for me, the practical nature of that is very much chop water, carry wood, just be engaged with your life, find the things that are nourishing and meaningful to you in your life and focus on that, focus on the body, try to be less interested in the mind and more interested in the body, and allow eventually, you know, the pull of the mind to reduce enough that the pull of the awareness of the body is enough to draw our consciousness in to meet it. And so there's a certain discipline, but it's more a discipline of I won't be distracted.
Mm-hmm.
And then just get on with one's life and really not,
right,
be too bothered about concepts or knowledge or,
right,
teaching. Or so anyway, for me it seems to be working. It's really, my life has become more and more simplified and streamlined. And
yeah,
the sense of purpose and meaning or higher thing, you know, that I was chasing after for so many years, they've become less interesting to me, but also more real. And it's a bit paradoxical, but my mind is less involved in them, but they're there, they're just,
yeah,
allowed to,
yeah,
happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree.
Hmm.
The way that I structure what you've just said is that basically when we're all wrapped up in these images, you know, that we pursue that finally cause us to become dissociated from who we really are, you know. That is the reverie. That is the function of the reverie. And really, it's compensating something. These images are compensatory.
Yeah.
So to get, you know, to cut to the chase, there is an emptiness that those images fill.
Yeah.
But they cannot, they can never bring resolution to that emptiness.
Yeah.
And so, and then we have the problem of the I, what we call the I, which also serves a function, because the I is like a repository of the memory of who you are, what they've said you are, the, you know, what you were born to, the family, the clan, all of those conditionings. They enable you to function in your material life. If you didn't have the I, you know, like that guy who wrote books about my hat, he thought his wife was a hat.
Yeah. Oliver Sacks, yeah.
Yeah. When the eye is somehow deranged, you can't function. You need it. But when you're dissociated, the eye is doing the job that it shouldn't be doing, mm-hmm. you know? And basically there is no self-criticism when that happens.
Right.
And you believe that you are that eye, and you're not. It's just a servant, you know? But when you begin to go inside yourself, if you have a good tool for doing so, which is why more and more people are meditating right now, you do come in contact with a totally different being within you. I don't like to call it the inner child. I just get so fed up with that jargon. Because sure. It has no identity. It's what they call the witness, right? And how to get to that. It's what Gandhi called the self, I guess, what they call the higher self. How to come in contact with that is like an urgency at this point for human beings. And that has a lot to do with the problem of suffering, because that dissociation, that pursuing images that only give you non-meaning at the end, and then so you pursue others. And that's the problem of non-meaning that has been wasted on us, because we have been told so many falsities. And it, what, you know, it's not a big surprise that we become false. I mean, but there's always something inside you that's like a horsefly, you know, that tells you, hey, come on, get off it. Stop, you know, stop lying to yourself. But if, unless you make a decision, you know, a conscious decision that you're going to change the way you live and pay the consequences of that, you know, unless you start to make these decisions and use your free will, and you know, up the road it'll be easier and easier to take that same decision. Whereas if you opt for the false life, you know, the quick riches or the I don't know what, you know, chercher la femme and all that stuff, you know, money, prestige, or sex, it's like your life becomes easier and easier to go in that same direction. And so that's what we call the contradiction or the unity, you know. You have to realize that your reveries, unless you examine what they are, and they question what they are, and you make a decision regarding them, whether you will go toward a more conscious life, which is full of obstacles and difficulties. It's kind of the dilemma that every human being finds him or herself in on this planet. But most of the time, the machine just grabs you and you're just inside the, you know, the washing machine going round and round, and you're totally mechanical. You know, go study, get a profession, one that'll give you lots of money, you know, and find the right mate, and, you know, get ahead, get respected, and gain power. I mean, 30 years ago, it wasn't as clear as it is now. And maybe that's what they mean when they say that the energies on Earth have changed, and the energies before were so dense and people were sleeping and snoring, and it was just impossible to wake them up. And now it's getting harder and harder to stay asleep. You know, for example, your friend, where he really tried, he wanted to ascend. He wanted to, he wanted spiritual illumination. You know, the consciousness has the power. If you train it in whatever the direction you're training it in, you're gonna get it, you know? So even if he didn't have any guidance from a sage or a teacher, he found it, and he found it on his own terms, which is great for him. But you know, the higher you ascend, you're gonna find more subtler and subtler challenges. You know, it never ends. You know what I mean? That it's dancing girls, and then later it'll be, I don't know.
No, I don't have too many hopes about that. Although I think there's a letting go and a relaxation that can become complete. I think that one
definitely
can,
you suffer less.
One can face challenges in a relaxed state, and
you are, for one thing.
Yeah, it was interesting earlier you said about there's no self-criticism, and I was agreeing because I thought you were saying something else, but you were, because to me, although I understand the way you meant it now, that people maybe aren't critical enough, on the other hand, I'd say that also we're all too critical of ourselves in the wrong way. It's not helpful. We're self-punishing and we're self-judging.
Right.
And to me, the relaxation and the state of becoming at ease in life, so that we can really live the lives that we were meant to be living, a really big part of that is just letting go of the need for self-criticism.
It has to do with recognizing your registers inside you. You know, one of the problems people have too is they don't trust themselves, and you actually have to accumulate a certain amount of process in order to gain that trust. It's not gratis, you know. It's not. You kind of have a relationship with yourself, and self-betrayal is a really central issue, you know.
Yeah.
If you have chosen to be true, whatever the cost, or if you have been negotiating and trying to, you know, get the best of both worlds and avoid really walking the talk.
Well, so many ways that we can trick ourselves with that, and we're in a world that seems to be configured with a great deal of cunning by ourselves, one way or another, to divert awakenings into new dream states. So even Dave would say that,
right,
yes, he got enlightened. Yes, he was a spiritual seeker for 30 years before he got enlightened, so he wouldn't deny there wasn't some correlation, like his yearning to discover the truth of himself certainly led him to that final moment. But he has no good words to say about the spiritual teachings and the marketplace that he was involved in and that he sees today. And because he feels that it's all almost entirely configured and designed by people who aren't really fully there. And so it's just full of these tricks and traps and snares. And that's also my experience on a different path, of more related to occultism and shamanic practices and so on, and psychedelics. My heart was in the right place. I was sincere, and I thought I was a good thinker, but it turned out, you know, the Matrix had me, really, and I just fell for so many of the bells and whistles, and there's so many counterfeits out there, and they look so much like the real thing.
Yeah.
That in certain sense, they do serve as the real thing up to a point. Like someone like Gurdjieff to me, or Castaneda, I think there's a lot of truth in there, but it's the medium for me that's the real message. And if the medium, him or herself, isn't truly trustworthy, then the message itself will somehow have these elements in them that will feed the worst part of ourselves, and so we'll end up just using the identity to try and get free of our identity, and so just reconfiguring our false identity in ways that make us think, you know, that we're making progress, and we're really not. And that was me for 20 years in a certain sense. Okay, I did learn discernment by doing the wrong, I was going to call my memoir All the Wrong Moves, because I did so many things wrong that I feel I'm a master now on how not to do it. And there's true value in that, possibly, for others. I mean, I am a sort of public teacher type person, so fine, I'm going to use it. But still, the fact remains, I spent 20 years doing things that really didn't help. And you know, sincerely seeking, and often turning to sincere people who are misguided.
Well, it's standing in that mirror, in the hall of mirrors, you know. That's the dilemma. It's like you're standing in their mirrors and you see your image being reproduced eternally in each mirror. My energy teacher told me there is a lot of confusion and charlatanism out there. It's a fact. It only tells us, you know, that the entire planet or humanity is moving toward in the direction of a new religious era. That's basically what it's telling us. And yeah, you have to go through trial and error. And I don't think those 20 years were a waste for you. You just had to go through them, just like I have had to go through my own hall of mirrors. You know, I realized 15 years in the movement, I had been absolutely deluded as to the person that I was with. Mm. You know, this man I was with for 11 years, I wanted to see what I wanted to see. And I had been in a goddamn movement for, you know, to understand my own internal mechanisms. But there is no way you can do that intellectually. You have to live through it.
Yeah, totally.
And then once you've lived through it, then you know what the registers are, and then you know you won't fall for that again because you've internalized it. But of course, you also have to reconcile with yourself.
Yeah.
No? Because if you don't reconcile, if you've accumulated grudges, they're just gonna make you mechanical again. You're just gonna fall into more and more sophisticated traps. But once you've learned your, you know, once you've gotten your little nugget of gold, it's yours. And that, to me, that's the whole point, you know. Not to be too ambitious either.
Yeah.
You're not gonna become Babaji, you know, or Paramahansa Yogananda, you know.
No, I recently decided that I was no longer believed in attaining enlightenment, and it wasn't a sensible thing for me to be seeking, and rather I would just seek now for no longer wanting that seemed like that would be a sufficient station to arrive at. Just okay, these higher states or these deeper things, they exist. And it's wonderful they exist, and that I've got closer to them than before. But in terms of really arriving at some final thing, forget about it. It's just that thing. It's like the horizon that gets further away the closer you get to it. Feeling so to me that seems realizable. To let go of what's driving me to arrive somewhere, I feel that's possible.
Yeah, in my case, it was saving the world. I just realized that I was not into that anymore. That was my fanatic stage.
Yeah.
I had to live through it. You know, you have to live through these things. Get them out of the way.
So when your experience with the movement and your disillusionment or your discovery about your partner, did that unfold... Was that related to your disillusionment with the movement itself or your realization?
Yeah, because he was my orienter. He was a big guy. He was an important person in the movement.
Right. Was it a hierarchy, the movement?
Yes, it was very hierarchical. Now, Silo dissolved it a few years before he died. I mean, it went through a whole, it was always going through changes, but before he died, he said, okay, it doesn't exist anymore, you know? And then he created something new, which is like the message. And it was just meeting together every week to read this text on the message and whatever. Mm-hmm. But basically, I learned from him that you do whatever the hell you want to do, you know? And you become your own point of reference. Mm-hmm. You know, the movement is not a refuge. It couldn't be for me because I observed all of the contradictory behavior in there. People were not saints. It was not heaven. I was asking things that nobody wanted to talk about. So I just had to go my own way and find out the answers. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't going to come from there. Because Silo, like, he like lit the match, and then, you know, the gunpowder, you know, it led to the keg, and there was a big explosion. It spread throughout the world, but really everybody was there to do their own thing, and yeah, humanize the earth. However you realize that you were born to do it, you've got to do it. And you can't be with a movement all your life to be in a room full of people with body warmth, you know. Mm-hmm. That's not it.
So did he say why he dissolved it when he did?
No, he didn't.
Do you have a sense?
I think that he knew that he was never interested in being adored. He was never interested in feeding people's reveries.
Yeah,
you know, there would be like shocks every from time to time. But basically, I got really bored with it. Mm-hmm. You know, where everybody's talking the same talk, and there's like a party line. And if you manifest interest in anything that's not included in the party line, nobody will talk to you. And I see that so much in human society, and I have no time for it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so at what point does a group of people become a cult? At what point does a community become a society? At what point does a movement get stuck? I mean, it seems, even when something becomes a movement, it's almost as though that means it's going to stop moving. Just the act of identifying it, or the phenomenon of something identifying itself as fixed, that seems to be the hardest space to negotiate. Because if people aren't coming together and sharing and participating, well, then you don't have a field. Nothing happens, right? But as soon as they do, there's always this risk, whether it's to do with size or something else, I don't know, but there's a risk that it will start to calcify.
I don't see a risk. I see, like, also what Silo was talking about, that the things have to respond to needs. And if the need is no longer there, well, you know, there was a time where there would be, like, spontaneous spontaneous emerging of an organization or an entity, and then when it has fulfilled its purpose, well, you leave it, you dissolve it, and you move on. And I think that that's how we have to see these things, because also people have different needs, you know. People have different paths, and in this sense, I really believe that we have many lives. Because there were so many people who were just, it was peachy keen for them to be in the movement here in Chile. They were just so happy. Until today, they're just like snug as a bug in a rug. And who am I to tell them that that's not good? That's what they need. That's what they have. That's great, but it's not for me. You know what I mean? And everybody should be free to find their own, you know, what makes you feel that you're growing. You know what I mean? No morality. No external morality. You know? the only rule is that you do not harm. As long as you don't harm anyone, you're free to do whatever you want.
I don't think that's a rule that can be observed, because I think we have ways of harming ourselves and others that we don't recognize.
At some point you can stop fooling yourself, right? And you realize you are doing harm. And when you get to that point, then you have a decision to make.
But, I mean, for example, Dave has talked about how a mother with a child in her womb, if she has a moment of doubt, maybe I don't want to be a mother, that the fetus will feel that and be hurt by it, and that will affect the development of the fetus. So it's really impossible not to do harm and exist, I think.
Well, if you look at it from another perspective, we have incredible capacity to overcome anything. So that fetus might be in her womb to teach her something.
So to me, it's about, I think there is a morality that we need, and I agree it's not external, but then I don't think anything real is external. I think the whole world outside of the body is unreal currently, the way that until we're enlightened. But so there's a world, but there's that the interior of our body, which I think you were touching on this, weren't you? The synesthesia, the sentience of the organs and so on. There's this whole dimension of our existence which is current and occurring and relatively uncolonized. Now, it's traumatized because we've been traumatized by the world, but Coca-Cola haven't yet put advertisements and product placements on our internal organisms. They get us to eat shit and all that stuff, but relative to the world that lies in the society we move in, this interior space of our bodies is untouched except by what we do to ourselves. And my sense there is that there's an innate sense of right and wrong in every moment in the body itself. And that if I'm in tune with my body, then it would become impossible, unless I were to deliberately say, I'm going to do something I would really regret, which itself would be absurd. It wouldn't be impossible, but it would be absurd. And I think I'm trying to say here, but I think we swing between extremes. So you were talking about these false polarities, you were talking about how people are all driven by this material thing of success and comfort, but there's an awakening. But to me, the people are also driven into these false awakenings and these false spiritual things,
right?
The law of attraction, the secret,
right?
Manifest destiny. And in a similar way, I think we tend to swing between having this false kind of morality, which is moralism, and do what thy wilt,
right?
Total liberation, and that's not healthy either. Whereas there is this middle path, which is
right.
The truth. It's an objective reality that our body's telling us all of the time.
Right. But to perceive it, your consciousness has to rise. Your awareness has to become elevated,
So I would say my consciousness has to sink and my awareness has to rise to meet it. So then two things that happen. But yes, without splitting hairs about language.
Yes.
I think the better in tune we are with our bodies, the more we will treat them and use them right, the more sensitive they will become, and that is a snowballing where it becomes easier and easier to do the right thing. I put the little quotes there because it's nobody's idea of the right thing, not even my own idea, but it just is the right thing.
So it kind of takes you to the idea that we human beings are the same. There is something about us that is objective, and not subjective.
Yeah, I think
there are laws. Laws do exist. We are. We do. Life does. Well, there are laws of life, and evolution. And if you get away from the chaos, you begin to perceive new realms, But you do have to do things to get there. It's not
Apparently, you know what I mean? Yeah. Although I think that, yeah.
And the other thing is that you will tend to gravitate towards people who are like you.
Yeah, that's really important.
And gravitate away from people who are not.
I think that's so important. The environment that we're in so much determines our experience of our own bodies and our own selves and our inner environment. And so, like for me, it's very, very difficult to follow Dave's example and just be tuning into my feet or my liver or my internal organs, because I'm just so far removed from that. But if I put my body in a beautiful place in nature and I'm in the sun and the river, and I start to my appreciation for nature and the beauty of nature, so it's so palpably good, like the sense of goodness that I find in nature, I start to experience my own body in a very different way and have an experience as a body that is different.
Yes.
And there's a transformation.
Yes.
There. And so I'd say that goes even more so for human beings, because that's nature too, like we are human.
Right.
Nature. And so
right.
Yeah, being with the right people, the right humans, resonate, you know, our organs and our inner worlds communicating and resonating, it makes all the difference in the world, because it's not that easy, actually, is to find people who I want to hang out with, simply.
Right.
Put, most of them are online currently. That's why.
Right.
I want to move to make this move to Europe and try and actually be part of a community where there's both, right, being in nature and also being with other humans, and like a monastic.
I don't think you should head back to Europe.
Well,
wait,
I'll come to Chile. Well, nowhere looks good right now.
You might have to replicate Europe where you are.
Well, it's about the people, as I say. Where are the people situated? And if everything grinds to a halt, and we can only travel around on horse and cart, I'd like to be able to be in touch with some of these people.
Yeah, right. Well, that comes to another, that takes me to another topic, which is how do we communicate with realms that are not visible for us, that are positive for us?
Mm.
For example, you know, when you're out in nature, what is it that you feel? It's an energy that is your same energy.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Well, I'm older than you are, so I'm basically at a stage where I'm observing aging, you know, something I was so frightened of all my life. You know, no longer being young and energy. I had so much energy, and I realized at a certain point in my 30s that what I valued the most was to have this energy that I had. And now I'm like observing what happens to the body, because it's a vehicle, you know, it's lent to us for a certain number of years, and you do have to take care of it. And it's not until you reach a certain age that you begin to realize that it needs certain things, that you can't just use it however you want and, you know, it won't complain. You start to separate yourself from it, you know? You become like a being that's inhabiting this body, because it's no longer fused with you. Like when you're young, you don't feel your body. You're just, you know, out in the world and doing your stuff. But when you get older, it begins to separate from you. You kind of have to take care of it.
Well, it's an ironic paradox, though, I think, because one of the reasons when we're young and we don't really feel separate from our body is because we're not even in our body, paradoxically. And by the same token,
you don't feel it. You are in it, but you don't feel it.
Well,
everything,
I'd say we're not
smooth.
In it. It depends what you mean by I, but the life force or the soul hasn't made it into this body. And that's what Dave talks about. It might make it down to here or something, but it doesn't make it past the eyes, because of the trauma and the toxins and the contraction of the body. The life force isn't able to come all the way in it.
Well, when you're young, you don't have that many toxins. Unless you
No, it's infant trauma. I mean, in my case, I was my mother was drinking when I was in the womb, so I was formed out of alcohol, out of toxins. So, and I think that that's not unusual. And even if a parent, a mother is an alcoholic,
That case, right.
So and but there is, I think paradox is truth, and I've said this about the world that I realized in my 40s, that because I never felt of the world, I always felt I was not of this world. But I also didn't really want to be in the world. I wanted to be in my head. And what I feel I've observed this trajectory in my since I turned 40 is the more in the world I can be, the less of the world I will be. But somehow those two things are complementary. So it's something to do with not having grudges, is how you put it, not having resistances, not being compromised, really being consciously in the world and able to interact with the world and thereby see the ways in which I'm not of it. Because unless we have a really close relationship with something, we can't really see it for what it is. And so I think it's the same with the body. Like, the more in my body I'm able to be, the more I can see that I'm not of my body, in the sense that I do exist, or even the body itself isn't limited to the borders of the skin. Like, our bodies, seems to me, they extend in both space and time beyond the outside of the physical body.
Something here, but you're talking about how we have more than one body, not just the physical one.
Well, I know those systems, yes, and I learned a lot of them, but I'm so I may
your emotions are a body, your thoughts are a body. I mean, we should really get away from that false idea that we are our bodies, because we aren't. I mean, or we're much more.
Or that the body is much more, is how I would put it. Because the body, just because we can only see the physical body, doesn't mean that it doesn't have these other layers. That are also conscious and also sensing. Yeah.
And there are layers internal too.
Internal and external,
the skin.
Yeah.
Actually, we have a body that corresponds to the digestive system, in other words, to the nervous system, you know, blah, blah, blah. We're really much more entertaining, you know, than we thought.
Oh, well, that's how Dave describes, you know, because for years I had an idea what an enlightened person would be like, and when I met Dave I said, you're not enlightened, I don't think. You're this, you might be this or that, but you're not enlightened, because he didn't meet my ideas about it, which were much more mind-based. And but since I've known him, you know, he's persuaded me that he's probably enlightened, and anyway, if he's not, my God, what could be beyond that, I don't know. But and he's described his body as 24/7 entertainment, because there's so much going on, and he seems to be so aware, you know, of little tugs on the skin, or the hairs on his arm, or the...
What is the shape of his body? What is his morphology? Can you describe him?
He's about 6 foot. He used to be skinny like me before he got enlightened, but then he filled out. So now he's pretty stocky, and he's got a belly. But he says because he spends so much time on the computer now because of all these different people.
Is he soft-bodied?
Soft. In the sense of not being hard, pumping iron, hard body. He's not flabby, if that's what you mean. He's very strong.
Is he pear-shaped?
No, he's not pear-shaped. No.
Okay.
He's like a sort of Saxon warrior kind of build, except he's got the belly. Okay. Well, they could have bellies too, didn't they, some of them? So.
But he sounds like a vegetative biotype. He's so focused on his body, you know.
Well, I don't know about that, but
because he loves food.
He likes to cook. He says that if everyone else would hurry up and get enlightened, he'd just be the cook. And the only reason he's the lead is the leader is because no one else has woken up yet. So, and he does like to talk about shitting and his dog and being in the forest picking mushrooms. He's definitely a physically oriented.
Yeah, he's a veggie, yeah.
And that's what I need in my life, is somebody who's like that. But I also feel that, and maybe it is just because that's what I need particularly, but that there's something very central to being enlightened, which is so different from what I thought, which is that awareness becomes much more sense-based rather than being conceptual. And that for Dave, as he describes it, the world of sensation is endlessly fascinating to him, and there's all this information. And he would talk about emotions also as sensations. Thoughts, they're also sensations. It's all sensational. But then
we translate it.
It's
just a contact.
Yeah.
There's a contact.
Yeah.
Oh, I find that relationships are much more interesting than just my organs.
You mean with other humans, or because that?
Yeah, right. Okay. I mean, even I often think back to my life and relationships I've had, and I keep looking at them from different facets, you know.
Yeah.
Or even my relationship with my two kids. But I'm not so body oriented. I'm much more oriented towards ideas.
Yeah, well, so am I.
And feelings.
So am I, I think. But I think, and they're not mutually exclusive, and nor is enjoying relationships with people and having a relationship with one's internal organs mutually exclusive. And in fact, I think one of the things Dave talks about that I've begun to have a sense of, and to think of it now with you and I, is that when two people meet and they connect, whether or not it develops into a relationship, which is a kind of amorphous idea anyway, our internal organs are connecting. So my liver is signaling to your liver, my heart signaling to your heart, all of this stuff's going. Imagine animals do this, like they smell each other's buttholes. Well, there's all this other stuff. We're transmitting.
Yeah.
And we're receiving so much information that the part that's going on above the neck and the you know, the words, and it's just a small fraction of
right
how we relate.
Right, exactly. We have energy bodies that overlap, that get entangled. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Quantum entangled.
But what do you think happens after we die?
That's a big question. Well, I try not to think about it, but only because I think about it every day, and so I think, well, you know, once a day is enough, and just okay, leave it alone now. What I think, the short version, is I think that we have to face the truth of our lives, or we die into the truth of our lives, and that's it, really. That's what's left of us. Is the composite of our experiences, and whether that we see, to me this is a very hard question to answer because I get into conceptual.
Let me ask you something else.
Yeah.
Have you ever had any psychic paranormal experiences?
Hasn't everyone? Who hasn't had
paranormal? No, a lot of people haven't.
Well, Richard Dawkins is one person, at least.
My son loves him.
But yes, is a short answer. I've had many paranormal experiences.
And doesn't that lead you to think that there might be something more after we die?
To me, this isn't a question of belief or not believing. I would say that I know that death is not the end of anything. Well, it's the end of the body, I suppose, or of I have to say goodbye to my body, and I have to say goodbye to everything and everyone I've ever known. That's what death means to me. As far as what's on the other side of death, I think to me it's really a question of, would I want my false identity to survive death or not? No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't want that to happen. I think it does happen. I think there are hungry ghosts and things like that, and the Egyptian pharaohs and God only knows, and sorcerers who, you know, I think there's all kinds of practices that are geared towards making that happen because of a deep fear of death.
And but they're not born of ordinary human beings. These are beings that have a lot more baggage than an ordinary human being.
Well, I wouldn't consider myself an ordinary human being, I don't suppose. I mean, it would depend on the context for that.
I think you're probably an ET or something.
Well, yeah, in that paradigm, I don't adhere to that paradigm anymore. But when I did, I was definitely a hybrid. So I definitely have a lot of baggage, sorcerer baggage, you know, from Atlantis or however we're going to frame that. I mean, I see it more as ancestral. I think for me, it doesn't quite work anymore to think of an individual self who's going to survive death, because I'm determined that my individual selfness won't survive this life. I would like to be free of it in this life, free of this unnecessary dichotomy between existing as an individual and just being part of the human soul, the collective human soul, which I know that I am. So yes, I can experience myself as separate because I've got this physical body, but internally the idea that I am seems like an idea that I could be free of before I die. So then after I die, I think it ought to be, well, it doesn't really matter, because life will continue, and the life force that, you know, that got to incarnate in this body will continue, and whether there'll be continuity of memory or something like that, I don't know. I mean, I can't even remember my dreams, I can't even remember my childhood. I'm not the idea that I'm only the person that carries the memories around, you know what I mean? That seems like a faulty idea. Mm-hmm. That's transhumanism. Like, we've got to store all our memories and convert them into digital data and somehow preserve them, and that will be us. I think that's a very deeply embedded idea in us, and it doesn't seem to correspond with reality. Now, I have family members who've died, and I have no doubt, really, that there's contact between me and them.
Okay.
But I don't know what that means exactly. I just know there's contact. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how that works.
Right.
Like, is it a package of energy that was a soul that carries memories, or is it just the memories that are somehow, you know, are still somehow autonomous on the other side? Or there's a number of ways to interpret it, right? And maybe none of them are accurate exactly. So I just stay with this felt sense that the relationship I had with my brother, for example, particularly my brother, my mother, my father, while they were alive, or the connection I had to them, I should say, because the relationship's over, is still there. There's still something on the other end of that connection.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was... like I became very, very tired of being here, and I just wanted to leave. But I know that you're not supposed to kill yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's awfully boring here.
Really? I've never been bored. In 53 years, I've not been bored. Not really. Maybe a bad TV show, I get bored.
I've been very bored. It's like, but I'm an Aquarian. We're kind of strange in that sense. We're like, I've always felt like, you know, why do human beings make such a big deal out of everything? And why can't things be rational, really rational and sensible? Why do people... Well, they just seem very irrational to me. And, but be that as it may, past 55, I started to feel like I was just running around in circles and just repitiendo el plato, you know? It's like the same thing over and over again. And really, if it wasn't for internet, you know, I really would be... I don't know.
At a loose end.
I wouldn't be a recognizable human being, I think. But I'm Filipino, and that makes a difference, because Filipinos are very irrational. You know, we're very connected. We live with irrationality. It's like normal for us, you know. That's why that country can be so corrupt and everybody's, hey, you know, life is good. Let's eat something. Let's joke around, you know.
That could like be healthy.
We can be completely oblivious to everything. Like we escape, you know. We're escapists. We're artists of that. And the other thing about us is we're very superstitious, and we believe in the existence of all kinds of beings. And there is like a stupid religious... you know, fanaticism in the Philippines, but behind that is the fact that we are deeply spiritual, and and I have that. I'm really irrational, but once my marriage ended and I was in Chile and I was stuck here and I didn't know what I was gonna do, I only knew that I didn't want to leave my two children who were still small, and so all the rationality of the movement just fell apart, and I started to open myself up to the invisible, okay? To the invisible realm. And I started to go see an astrologer, you know? She read my birth chart. I knew her because she lived in that semi-rural area where I was living. And she was really great, and for 10 years, I would see her once a year, and she really helped me, you know, get out of the pit, you know, the black pit of being here, because you have no idea how boring Chile is.
I bet I wouldn't be bored.
What?
I bet I wouldn't be bored. You must have beautiful nature, mountains and rivers. And...
Well, yes, but I'm talking about society.
But society is always boring wherever you go.
Yeah, but I lived in the States and I kind of can compare, you know what I mean?
Wow, no, I would, that would be the last place in the world. If I could live anywhere but the States, I would live wherever it was, I think. I'm being a
Well,
bit hard, but
you couldn't, okay. I couldn't have this kind of a conversation with anybody,
in Chile,
okay?
well, I can't in my town in Hope either. It's true, the internet opens up all kinds of possibilities.
But you have a partner, at least. I
yes.
imagine you talk to your partner a lot.
Yes, I do have a partner. I agree
Well, ever
that's
since age 39, I haven't been able to talk to anybody like that. Oh, there have been like, yeah, there have been intervals, but basically, I'm a super intimist, you know?
yeah.
In fact, there's always tons of things happening inside me and that I basically shut up about until I was in my 20s and in the movement. Then it was okay to talk. But then when I got to Chile, I realized people don't talk here. It's not, you can only talk like everybody else. It's hard to explain to you, but the movement
No,
was a really it was a structure, you know what I mean? If you didn't fit in there, you were screwed, you know?
it sounds to me more like you're lonely than bored.
Yeah, but then ever since I was a kid, I've spent a lot of time being alone. And in fact, that was what my astrologer said, you know, you were alone when children shouldn't be alone. But I think that it ha also has to do with one's karma, you know, with the kind of a life that I had agreed to live here. But whatever. Getting into the net, I started to discover all these things about, this was years later, and I have like no boundaries. Yeah, everything goes okay. If they tell me this or that, fine, that must be true for them. But I really did get into this thing of dialoguing with the invisible, okay? And it turned out to be the healthiest thing for me in the end. But getting, you know, snooping around the net, I came across these mediums and I came across these books that have been dictated from the other side to mediums about what it's like on the other side, okay? And there are two very interesting personalities. Ah, I didn't mention to you that from childhood, I started to fall in love with dead people.
People that you knew who died, or
Yeah,
something
who were
else?
dead. I mean, actually, the first one was Lawrence of Arabia, whom I discovered when I was 14.
I see,
I was
okay.
always reading, okay? And unlike you focused on Clint Eastwood, I focused on heroes, yeah? And Lawrence of Arabia was like my hero for, you know, when I was a teenager. And not long ago, I realized that when you focus on spirits, you can establish a line to them. They know when somebody is thinking of them repeatedly and with a lot of intensity. Yeah, and I found these communications through mediums and these books that were dictated through automatic writing. Okay, and the first one who really blew my mind was William T. Stead. Have you ever heard of him?
No, well, I don't think so.
Okay, William Stead was born, lived in Victorian England, and he died on the Titanic. He was 62, and he was on his way to New York to give talks because he was the inventor of socially oriented journalism, or using journalism to pressure a government to establish social reform. Okay, you have to go because we've been talking a long time.
Pretty soon. I usually try and keep it to 2 hours, but do finish your current
Okay,
thread. Yeah.
okay. So William Stead was a real cool guy, and he discovered that there was traffic of little girls in the bordellos of London. And he denounced that by buying a little girl himself to show that it could be done. So he bought I guess an 11-year-old girl, and he came out with it, and he got sent to jail for 3 months.
Because he was because he had
right,
assault
because
himself.
He had done that. Yeah. But
pretty
he's
small
very
sentence.
Famous for a book that he wrote regarding that social problem, right?
Was he effective in bringing awareness to it or not?
Yes, yes.
He was.
He did. He has a very, very famous book called, I forget the title. Well, anyway.
I'll tell you if you want. He was the British, he was a newspaper editor.
W.T. Stead, yeah. S-T-E-A-D.
Yeah. Editor of the Pall Mall Gazette.
That's it, yeah, yeah.
Actually, it doesn't mention his books. It doesn't mention any books.
Victorian child traffic. You could look for.
And he was one of the characters you connected to when you were young.
Yes. Well, no. Just recently.
Then
I also found a posthumous diary by T. Lawrence,
mm-hmm.
by Lawrence of Arabia. You know, he died at. He was 45, and he was speeding on his motorcycle, and to avoid killing three young people riding their bikes, he slammed into the forest. And
yeah, they didn't show that in the movie. In the movie, he just falls off or whatever.
No, he survived for 6 days, and then he died.
Right.
But his posthumous diary it's just really good reading. And W.T. Stead communicated with his daughter after the Titanic sank. And he dictated to her what it was like to reach the Blue Island, what he called the Blue Island. And so, nada, it seems that when we leave here, it's really fantastic. It's just the most fantastic thing you can think of, but apparently you do have to get there in good shape. I mean,
good
you have
condition.
To be happy, because however you die, you're gonna be in that state on the other side. So you better get your act together. So that's pretty much my thing. It's like to stay here for the remaining amount of time that is inescapable, and you know, do that writing that I mentioned to you.
Well, be careful. You may find that by the time you're 70, you're having such a great time that you're thinking, oh, why can't I have another 50 years?
I won't, because the body is such a drag to live in, you know, past a certain age.
Well, I already feel age creeping, but I'm still more comfortable in my body than I've ever been before, even if my body itself is less comfortable in some ways.
Yeah, you're doing real great. Yeah, actually, I'm not doing badly either.
You don't seem to be.
But I don't know. You don't like to be in your head too much, but I really enjoy it, because to me, my head is not a prison. I think that we can travel through multiple dimensions even while we're here, that we actually do it. We just don't call it that, you know? So that makes life much more fun. I mean, I did learn to enjoy being here. I mean, I really do love it here, actually.
So. Uh-huh. So you're a bit divided then. You're bored.
No, I'm not. I'm resigned, if you like.
Uh-huh. To the Chilean reality.
No, but I live in a bubble. I mean, I have my own reality here. I'm really not caught in that box. I was before, but not now. Of course, it's a thing in your head, you know. If you think you are, then you are. You think
yeah.
you aren't, you're not.
Yeah.
You know?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of dead people, we never even got to Martine. Is it Martine?
Oh, Jose Marti.
Jose Marti.
Jose Marti.
Yeah, and I sent that, the image, Google images, to people I know, saying, look, one of my ancestors. And most of them were like, what? What are you talking about? They didn't even see the resemblance, which I thought was very disappointing, because not that I want to look like the guy, but I just thought it was so striking that
you
it was
do.
Uncanny. It gave me chills. I thought it was like time travel. It's like, yeah. It's like if I travel back in time.
What?
If
what?
I travel back in time and then had to go in disguise as a Cuban revolutionary, well, there's your proof. That's how I felt about it. My wife agreed, but others didn't see it. So,
well, they don't want to then.
I guess not. Anyway, so we never got to him. But
maybe have you looked him up at all?
Well, I did look him up, but I only read the Wikipedia because I have so many other things that
That's
keep
boring.
Grabbing my attention. But I just
boring.
Wanted to get a gist of him. He was a very interesting man. He died at 42. He was shot, partly because he wanted to prove that he was not a coward, I think, was the version
Can you
I
see
read.
This?
Yeah, Jose Martín, sus padres y las siete hermanas. So
yeah.
His parents and the seven sisters. So he had...
Right.
He had seven sisters, did he?
Yeah, but two died in childhood.
So he had five living sisters.
And this is like an emotional biography. Really good. Really good.
So you
and I have this. You see this?
Is he on that? Oh, there he is. Oh, so
yeah.
He's made it to the banknote. That's how successful he was. Well, I hope I don't follow in that tradition, because I'd hate to think my face would end up on a banknote. The irony of things. The agony and the irony. Yeah, well, so thanks for that anyway, and thanks for today, but also thanks for sending me that character from the past, because it just felt...
It's cool.
Yeah. It's curious. I mean, I know we have doppelgangers in this world, you know, that we don't usually meet, but
yeah,
I hadn't
yeah.
considered I might have a doppelganger somewhere in the past.
Yeah. Well, so thank you very much.
I'm glad we met via Sean Atwood. I've connected a few people because of that interview, but you're the first one I've spoken to, and that's my yardstick for a successful interview. Not if I get lots of book sales, that's nice too, but if I actually make a couple of meaningful connections as a result, then that seems to be what the gold is.
Yeah. I think Sean is great.
You like him, do you?
I think he's a hybrid.
He looks like a...
Yeah. He sure looks like one.
That's why I can't shave my head. No matter how thin my hair looks, I cannot shave my head. I tried it once and, you know, children run from me on the street. Mummy, it's an alien.
Well, I did have an experience, you know, like in 2001. That was a really bad period, very, very difficult. And one night I went to bed and I got up like at 3 a.m. to go to the bathroom, I guess. And I went back to bed and I was facing the wall, and suddenly I felt this giant hand go like this to the back of my head. And I was kind of in, I was almost falling asleep, and I felt it, and I didn't feel any fear. I felt a wonderful sensation of being comforted, you know? And I don't know if it was God. Now I think it might have been an ET, but it was really amazing. It was a giant hand. You know how you have your senses? It's like you have eyes outside of your head.
Maybe it was a body memory of being a child.
No,
when
wasn't.
You're a child, an adult's hand would feel like a giant hand.
No, it wasn't.
Well, to consider it. It doesn't have to be either or, it can be both.
You know, there are things that you know. There just are things you know.
Then there's things that you don't want to know also. So.
Yeah, you could tell me that if I were 21, but I'm 66. I know what I feel, and well, anyway, that's why you shouldn't tell people things, because then they you know, they spit on it.
But to me, that makes it more interesting. You see,
what?
that an angel or whatever would come in the form of a body memory as when we were children. Like those two things could be, they could both be true. That makes it more interesting to me.
Yes. However, you must not induce anything when somebody tells you something. You should just leave it alone.
Oh, I can't do that.
That's the rule.
I can't possibly do that. Wouldn't be able to have a conversation then.
Then you can't be a therapist.
Oh, I've got no desire to be a therapist. So.
Anyway, I do think that things are coming that are pretty even more incredible than what we've seen so far. So that gives me a feeling that it'll be worth hanging around a little longer. So.
Curiosity alone will keep you around.
More of an intuition rather than curiosity. I feel curiosity every morning when I turn on my computer.
Not when you look out the window?
Oh, when I look out the window, I just feel love, you know. Yeah. I have these beautiful surroundings from the moment I wake up. Yeah. I love being here. I'm just so grateful to be here because I was in a very difficult place before I came here. So, and I asked to get out of there. So are you, right? You're in a pretty nice...
I'm in a very beautiful place, yes.
Area.
And I can look out the window now and I'm looking at an enormous great mountain, Mount Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, whichever direction I look in where we live, there's a huge mountain looking back at
me. Yes, I'm surrounded by mountains as well. Yeah. They're the lower ones, but they're wonderful. And, you know...
Yeah. So.
Oh, you know what? I watched a video of you playing guitar. It was from 2009.
What was the song?
Yeah. But, you know, I feel things. I don't see auras or anything like that. But when I saw that video, it felt like you, I didn't see it visually, but it was like there was this darkness around you. Really thick darkness around your head, you know.
Which song was it?
I don't remember. I couldn't tell you.
Was it Little Johnny Golden Hands?
Yeah, that was the one. Yeah,
it's about John DeRuta, this cult leader in Canada who has been up to no good, who I was following, and that was the period that I was finding out the truth about him. And
okay.
So that song was that was a message to him.
Okay.
Yeah, interesting about the darkness. So you're saying the darkness was there and now it's gone, or you're not sure?
I don't see any now, but in that video, it seemed like you were really sad, you know, or something dark was. Had you in its clutches or something like that.
That was how I felt about John, but at that particular time.
It was
a difficult time.
Well, they're really important. They're really, those people are masters too, you know. Our masters.
That's the end of my conversation with Liz. Next week's podcast is the continuing exegesis of Maurice Burman's Wandering God with Tim Kay. Change with the times, dangers in the dark, clouds up and downtown. Changes in your soul, they happen all the time. Strangers in the dark, change with the times. And all the little sins, all the letdowns and wins. Things you begin with, the things that you end with, the changes in the heart change with the times.
Change with the night.